off 2 years ago at the Last Hope Conference. We basically went over the Zeus and the Spy Eye Trojans, as well as a few exploit kits. And back then, things were a bit different. A lot has changed in 24 months. A bit about me for those who are this is their first time. I work in information security. I've worked with defense contractors and banks doing vulnerability analysis and penetration testing. I'm currently working with the PLX cert team at Prolexic, doing forensics, intelligence analysis, and threat research on DDoS tools and techniques. And I'm also president of the Hack Miami Hackerspace out of South Florida and on the board of the South Florida OWASP. And standard disclaimer, all the information contained in this presentation is for informational purposes only. Don't actually attack servers. We're going to discuss vulnerabilities. Don't actually engage live systems. Downstairs in the mezzanine level, we have a capture the flag that's running that incorporates all the tools that we're going to be discussing in this. So if you're looking to exploit some crime kits, we have a very safe lab environment downstairs to be able to do that with, and you'll be able to try out the exploits that we'll be going over. And even if you do really want to try it and you find bulletproof servers that are hosting this type of stuff, don't do it if you're an American. The FBI likes to hunt Americans. And all information that's contained in this was obtained legally through third parties in accordance to the laws of the land from which they reside. So the last time we spoke, Zeus 2.0 was still a private kit. The older versions of Zeus were circulating publicly, but the 2.0 was still private. SpyEye was fairly new and hadn't yet been publicly leaked. Automated credit card shops, those were a rare phenomenon. They had started to emerge, but they weren't as prevalent as they are today. Most of the crimeware kits, the vulnerabilities that existed, were still private. They were just circulated among the underground and within the intelligence communities, but they weren't disclosed in public knowledge like they are today. The black hole exploit kit was in its infancy. Today, it's the one of the primary exploit kits that are in use. Things like Bitcoin didn't exist. Peer-to-peer cryptocurrency as a concept has emerged within the last 2 years. And Adobe products in 2010 were the most vulnerable vector. That is also now changed. And here, just a bit of nostalgia. Here's what the black hole beta kit back from 2010, before it was publicly on the market or before it was the comprehensive product it is today with licensing and automatic updates and all that stuff. That was back when Phoenix and Fragus and Yes were still the main exploit kits that were circulating the underground. And since this time, Java is now the new attack vector of choice. Oracle seems to be slow to patch their updates. Automated fraud shops are now so common that just Googling CVV shop will lead you dozens of results and dozens of news articles about recent FBI arrests and raids and domain seizures related to that market. The major crimeware kits such as Zeus and SpyEye are now public, down to the source code level where you can even examine the code of the builders that are making the executables. And vulnerabilities in crimeware kits have been made public. Remote file inclusions, file uploads in Zeus, and SQL injections in SpyEye and Eleanor, as well as others. Also, DDoS attacks have become more prevalent. The rise of hacktivism over the last 2 years with all the different anonymous campaigns that really significantly increased the focus of media attention on DDoS attacks and the overall awareness of DDoS attacks. And the more tools are now available to conduct these types of attacks that are simpler than ever, specifically booter scripts. The bar has been lowered when it comes to the technological requirements, the understanding to be able to launch these attacks. The concept of opt-in botnets also emerged, where instead of spreading malware among different machines, you will just convince users to run a tool and participate in a target. So you're basically becoming part of a botnet because you're choosing to. It's part of the hacktivist techniques or digital activism. New crimeware kits were released, specifically Dirt Jumper, which is a Russian DDoS toolkit, actually very potent. We'll be going into it in detail later. And also Zemra was another Trojan, which has recently been released into the news and leaked and also discussed in the news, and we'll be going into that into detail as well. There's been an increase in law enforcement activity surrounding all of this, and there's been an emergence of peer-to-peer cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, but there's been a surprising lack of interest from the underground. It hasn't really completely taken off, and that's probably a good thing because a lot of good things can be done with Bitcoin. The new attack vector of Java. Most new exploit kits, specifically the black hole exploit kit, they now make use of Java vulnerabilities which are released, and Oracle is very, very slow to patch. They have pretty slow patching cycles, so it could be several weeks to several months from the time a vulnerability is disclosed to the time Oracle gets around to actually patching it. So that window of opportunity is very large, and attackers are leveraging that window of opportunity and developing exploits that are Java-based and including them into automated exploit kits for things like drive-by downloads. The new version of Black Hole advertises a Java vulnerability, as reported on KrebsOnSecurity.com. And we also have the rise of the automated fraud shop. These are basic PHP MySQL scripts that sell digital goods, except in this case, the digital goods are usually credit card numbers, Magstripe data, PayPal logins, email accounts, or basically any other type of collected credential that can be used for some type of fraudulent activity. The way these work is users will either pay a fee to join the site, and they usually heard about it from a carding form or something like that, and they'll usually have to pay a fee to even register to be able to access the site. And once they've paid that fee, they can fund their account and then just start adding items to their shopping cart and check out with an anonymous e-currency, and usually can get away with a good amount of credit card numbers for depending on the shop between $2 to $5 a piece, or $7 to $10 above a piece for European cards, and the scripts originally were exclusively private scripts that were. You had to buy it from a developer on a carding form. But as time goes on, customers get disgruntled and scripts get leaked. So now these type of scripts are freely available. If you look around on forums, people are giving them away. There have been hacked ones that have been released, and several of the most popular shops have been breached by pretty much everyone in the book. Everyone's been hitting these sites because they're a trove of both, pirate digital booty and intelligence for both security consultants and law enforcement. Most recent raid was Operation Card Shop, which took place in June of this year, where the FBI did a sweep and arrested 24 people who were engaged in carding activity. Some people were also running automated shops, and they also had created a honeypot forum called Carter's Profit that was run by the FBI, and basically just kind of sat back and watched as carders from all over came and started engaging in transactions, and then they closed up shop in June and made 24 arrests. One notable breach took place during the spring of 2011. It was reported on a French language information security blog. Apparently, a French hacker was able to breach a credit card selling shop. And once they breached it, they were able to obtain the actual PHP scripts for the shop and the MySQL database. And with that, they were able to get administrative access to the application, a list of all the users on the shop, all their passwords, and all the transaction data as well. Word of the breach spread pretty quickly because it was a pretty prominent site. It was discussed on Pastebin and various other underground forums. When this was going on, some of our researchers at Hack Miami were able to obtain screenshots that were being posted on the forums by the person who had done the breaches, and they were able to see the statistics from the administrative panel, which gives a good snapshot as to the scale of the underground economy that's going on, especially when this is just, when you take into account that this is just a single website and there are hundreds of them now. And so let's look at some statistics. This is the statistics panel from the card shop, from the administrator panel. They can log in and manage their sales and see exactly what they're doing. From between April 2010 and April 2012, there was over $600,000 worth of data that was sold on the site through Liberty Reserve e-currency. Their most busy month was August and September of 2010. That's when they peaked. They made about close to $200,000 just in those 2 months, and the rest of the month just kind of trickled off as they got into other things. Most of the time, the people running these shops aren't hackers themselves. They're simply buying up bulk databases from hackers and then including it as inventory in their shop and marking up the price. Here's another statistical analysis from the shop. This was the top users, the top 10 purchasers. About 9% of the business for the entire shop came from the top 10 users. And over the course of the year, just those 10 users spent about $55,000 on this buying credit cards from this site. And the administrator is obviously sloppy, which is why we're able to be looking at these statistics today. For some reason, they appeared to have a backup file called test.txt that had every single Liberty Reserve transaction that had ever taken place on the website, destination account numbers, where the funds were coming from, the batch ID of the transaction, and the amount that it was for. So basically, anyone who ever bought a credit card number from this site, their account information was available for public viewing just by browsing to test.txt on this shop. And in addition to leaks such as that, we've had things like Zeus and SpyEye that have been leaked through various publicly accessible malware forums. There's been a significant increase in infections and the participation in these communities overall because these previously private kits are now publicly available for free, whereas they used to cost a few hundred to a few thousand dollars. You can just download them and play with them. And again, most of the public releases contain backdoors because they're releasing them with the intention of being able to take over botnets once people have started using the tools and making it work. And also, because these are now publicly available, you have an entire community dedicated to researching the scripts and code, looking for vulnerabilities within the command and control servers. And there's been many that have been discovered and publicly released, and we'll be going over several of those. Here are some Zeus vulnerabilities. And again, all these vulnerabilities we're going to be discussing, try them in a lab environment. We've got one downstairs on the mezzanine level. All these kits are set up. You can run these exploits against them and see how they work. Zeus has a remote file upload vulnerability. Previously, this was just circulated among very small communities of people, mostly within the security industry and also within the underground. Basically, when Zeus communicates to the command and control server, it sends an encrypted post request. And that encrypted post request will write a file to the server that has all their key log data and the stuff that the Trojan's been collecting from the machine. And by impersonating a bot and sending a post request that's encrypted with the key from the server, you can obtain the key for Zeus, the encryption key, either by extracting it from one of the binaries or just with a simple brute force attack. If you encrypt a post request, sending it to the gate.php drop zone for Zeus, it's possible to write PHP files and executable files to the server. And if you can browse directly to the reports directory and find where that file is, you'll be able to execute it, and you'll get like a C99 or an R57 or whatever you've uploaded to the server to execute just by accessing it. If you analysts, we've it's very possible if you browse through the reports directories on various public Zeus botnets, if they're publicly accessible, there's a good chance you're going to find C99 and R57 shells that are already there, and you can just kind of see the compromised bot as is. And back in fall of 2010, a security researcher named Billy Rios from excess-sniper.org put out a very cool tool. It's a PHP script that will emulate the post request to upload a file to a Zeus botnet. So you can, if you know the encryption key, you can just pop it into the script, or you can set it to do a little tweaking on it, make it brute force the script, or just set and try to extract it from the binary. And we also, regarding extracting the key from the binary, there's a blog on Threat Expert called Almighty Zeus that describes the process of extracting the encryption key from a Zeus binary. So that, combined with Billy Rios' tool, can result in compromising Zeus botnets. And again, don't do this in the wild. That it's attacking a server. You can do it downstairs, and you won't go to jail, and it's much more fun. SpyEye had multiple SQL injection vulnerabilities that have recently been made public. They're blind SQL injections on those two files, form finder epsub 2 and form cards edit. The ID parameters are unsanitized and vulnerable to SQL injection. There's been a blog that was also written by Seknichi, and they've go step by step on extracting database information from the SpyEye database through an SQL injection attack. There's two vectors of attack that you can use with an SQL injection against SpyEye. You can either use the SQL injection to read configuration files on the server and pull credentials that way, or you can use it to read the database and pull credentials that way. It depends on how the SpyEye administrator has set it up. But again, only do it in a lab. And other crimeware kits have also had public vulnerabilities. The Eleanor exploit kit, which we discussed about 2 years ago, is one of the more popular exploit kits in 2010. It now has public SQL injection vulnerabilities. A PDF was released on ExploitDB called "Hacking the Skiddies," which is about taking over Eleanor exploit kits. And the Black Energy DDoS botnet also has an SQL injection vulnerability that allows you to dump entries from the database. And that was also released by Billy Rios, the same researcher who released the Zeus backdoor. And, again, only do white hat vigilante stuff in a lab. And there's been a resurgence of DDoS, distributed denial of service. Has become more prevalent within the last 2 years, mostly due to the rise of hacktivism causes and various global movements that are using DDoS as a protest tool. The use of traditional malware-based botnets that conducted DDoS, things like Dirt Jumper, or those old school IRC botnets that do DDoS attacks. Those merge with the concept of opt-in botnets. And those are tools we'll be going into, like the high-orbit ion cannon and the low-orbit ion cannon, which specifically are one single-user denial-of-service tools that become distributed denial-of-service when enough participants are gather for the attack. And as we stated earlier, the bar for the technical barrier of entry has significantly been lowered for attackers wishing to participate in DDoS attacks, because the toolkits and scripts that are available now are incredibly simple to use and very potent. Dirt Jumper is a powerful botnet toolkit that was released publicly at the end of 2011. It was available in private since about January of 2011. For sale, it was selling for about $600, and then it got leaked around October. It was made as a spin-off from the Ruskill strain of malware. It's definitely a Russian botnet. It's very stripped down and simple. It's it's primary. Most of the way people get infected with it is they won't just get hit with a drive-by download and then it'll just get hit with Dirt Jumper. They'll usually already be infected with some kind of malware, and Dirt Jumper will just be a payload that's pushed out to it later on when they want to be able to utilize a DDoS attack from their already existing botnet. The CNC panel of Dirt Jumper is actually fairly secure. You can't even access the login page unless you know the username and send it in a GET request. And it's got fake 404 errors all over it. So if you're trying to fingerprint it with a web fuzzing application like WFuzz, it's gonna give you seemingly legitimate 404 responses. But there are subtle differences between the real 404 responses and the Dirt Jumper generated 404 responses. So you can kind of get a feel for if there is an actual command and control server there. It advertises that it makes use of four different attack methods. When we tore it apart over at the PLX cert, we discovered that for the most part it's primarily just GET floods and POST floods. They'll have several different named attacks, but when you look at the traffic, it's just a GET flood. And it'll try to randomize the HTTP headers, the refers, mostly the refers and the user agents to try to avoid detection, make it look like legitimate traffic. But again, it always has static signatures. We put together a very comprehensive analysis of it. We have mitigation signatures available to the public as well at prolexic.com/DDoS-dirt-jumper.html. We do release periodic threat advisories that reverse engineer these toolkits and discuss what they do, how they work, and the best ways to mitigate them on your network. And it's available free to the public from prolexic.com, from the threat advisory section. Here's an image of the Dirt Jumper control panel. It's a very stripped down interface. It only has a couple inputs. Where the target URL, how many threads or flows do you want the machine to run against it, and then there's a start and stop button. This is a screenshot from version 3. When we did the analysis, that was the version that was publicly leaked. Since we've released the threat advisory, Dirt Jumper 5 has come out and advertises that it has an anti-DDoS mitigation feature that randomizes additional headers during a post flood. It seemed to be more hype than an actual threat regarding being able to beat DDoS mitigation, because all it did was add an extra randomization field on the post flood and then called it an anti-DDoS flood. So it seems to be mostly just a marketing technique. And that's come out within the last, gained prevalence within the last couple years has been booter scripts. These are used in the denial of service attacks or DDoS attacks that they're simple stripped down PHP or ASP files. It's just a single file. They're freely available. You can go to Pastebin and type booter script and you'll see dozens of examples of them. Essentially, all they're doing is sending GET floods or UDP floods. And they're incredibly simple to use. You can get novice attackers are doing is they'll obtain these public booter scripts from either a forum or Pastebin. Then they'll just sign up with a bunch of free hosts, put the file on the free hosts, and then set it to start attacking a target. And eventually, free hosts kind of catch on to that and set up signatures for these publicly known shells. Not all of them are doing it, so it can still be pretty effective for short periods of time. But through very simple web application vulnerabilities, attackers are also uploading these files to web servers. So basically what happens is through a simple remote file inclusion or any way to write a file to a server, an attacker is able to convert that server through a single file upload and turn it and use all the bandwidth from that server in a DDoS attack, which is significantly more powerful than infecting a bunch of workstations with a piece of malware and having them work all together. So basically, it's with less effort to spread these. Basically, attackers are able to use less machines that are easier to infect to do more powerful attacks. And booter scripts are a big reason for this. I have some screenshots of what they actually look like and what their interfaces are. You can get these long lists of booter shells that just circulate on Pastebin, and they're are programs called bootloaders, which are either standalone clients written by, you know, people who are usually just getting into to programming, or these web application-based bootloaders where you can just feed a list of these shells into the bootloader and give it the target, and it'll start hitting them all. And what's interesting about the communication methods of these is these traditional botnets like Dirt Jumper that are malware-based rely on the command and control server to they rely on the infected client to connect back to the command and control server and receive instructions, whereas these sit quietly awaiting to receive instructions from the attacker or the bootloader. And the only way they'll receive those instructions is if you know where they're actually located. And there's an entire economy based around these where hackers will just go around infecting web servers, dropping booter script shells, and they'll sell the lists to people who want to be able to use DDoS attacks. Like, oh, you don't know how to do a web application attack? Here's a list for a few bucks. You could just use this list to start attacking these websites. And again, PLX Cert has done a comprehensive analysis of several booter scripts, how they work, the economy that surrounds them, and the entire, you know, script kiddie scene that surrounds it. But it's actually pretty sophisticated and pretty and way more powerful than it should be because of the amount of bandwidth that these scripts are able to utilize from compromised servers. And that's at prolexic.com/threatadvisories.html. Here's a screenshot of the Green Shell booter script. Very simple, straightforward PHP file. Once it's uploaded to the server, all it asks for is the destination and the length of time you want to run the attack for. And all this does is send a UDP flood. So if you don't want to have to even use this little GUI interface, you can just send a GET request of, you know, greenshell.php target equals and time equals. And then what bootloaders do is it'll just send those commands to the entire list of shells. And then you're able to leverage a pretty powerful DDoS attack using incredibly simple tools and techniques that really shouldn't work in 2012, but they are, and they're gaining way more prevalence because they're easier to do. More people are using them, and this is the result. And what's another interesting thing about the Green Shell booter script? It's not displaying here, but there's a broken image within the Green Shell booter script that used to be a big pot leaf. And that was hosted on the server of one of the authors of the script. So what would happen is every person who would use this tool and drop a shell on a server, anytime it would be accessed, the image would make a request to the server that's being hosted. So the guy who wrote the script is just getting all these nice long lists of infected machines, and that's fairly common with a lot of these scripts. And we talked a little bit about opt-in DDoS tools. This is the low-orbit ion cannon. It's got a lot of people arrested because it has no support for proxies whatsoever, and most people don't know how to use it. A lot of people using it didn't know enough to use VPNs. It's just a very simple GET flood, very stripped down headers, nothing that fancy. It crashes a lot, especially when you want to use a high thread count. It only becomes effective when you have large amounts of people coordinating to use this in an attack, like with the anonymous campaigns. And something that was real funny is during those campaigns, when this was circulating among those groups on IRC, a lot of people were backdooring them with Zeus because why not? And everyone who was participating in the attack became part of a larger botnet. This is the high-orbit ion cannon. Very similar to the low-orbit ion cannon. It was just the next generation of it. This makes use of booster scripts, which are these visual VB script files that you're able to feed into the tool that are basically lists of randomized headers and randomized headers like referrers and user agents. And that has the attempt to bypass any type of mitigation or detection. But again, it crashes a lot. It's pretty poorly coded. It has no support for proxies and is only effective when you're using it with a large group of people and coordinating. And we've also done a comprehensive analysis of this tool and reversed it, and that's available on the Prolexic Threat Advisory section. Recently in the news, Zemra has been getting a bit of press. It got a lot of hype because it seemingly combined the features of Zeus and SpyEye with DDoS capabilities, which was fairly innovative. Hadn't really been seen to be that popular of a combination. It's based off the Seek malware kit, almost identical in database structure and command and control user interface. They make some pretty impressive claims about the tool in the advertisements on underground forums, to the point where it's a bit suspicious as to if this is actually a functional tool. For example, it's only selling for $100, and compared to the market price of other tools, that is way too cheap for something that supposedly has these features and also has the ability to spread via USB infection. Just that alone flags something that there's not something legit about this crimeware product. And the tool was released for private sale, I'd say about April or May, and within a few weeks it was already leaked, and the builder code and the CNC panel code was available. So when you go through the code, it shows that a lot of the code seemed to have been ripped from things like the Seek malware kit, but it could have been the same author. But the builder was also ripped from some other portions of it were ripped from some other popular German botnets as well. So that's pretty common among inexperienced malware coders to just borrow code from other projects. And since there was no copy protection, licensing, or any of the fancy things that now exist in crimeware kits, it shows that they're somewhat inexperienced. And that's another thing that developed within the last 2 years, licensing for crimeware kits, which to the point where the PHP scripts will be encoded. You can't even see them. It's just, it's built and coded to your server and only work with your server. And they'll have these managed update services that'll just push out the updates to it when it's ready. And they'll be based in countries where there's absolutely nothing that can be done about that. And another interesting thing about the Zemra leak, which is common to most other leaked products, they're all backdoored by default, with the most obvious backdoor that I've ever seen. If you just go to systemcommand.php, it's a PHP CMD command. You can just ?CMD equals cat etc password or any command, and that's it. You've got it. And mostly what people are using is to dump configuration files, and they get login creds, and then they can take over the botnet. So basically, and what I assume is that the person who leaked this toolkit was just looking to take over other command and control panels. And noble cause, it seems to be work. Got a bunch of press, so I'm sure they're doing that. And that was just one that we're able to see just by looking at the files, like command.php, what's this? Oh, so like I'm sure there's SQL injections. I'm sure there's all sorts of horrible vulnerabilities within this panel. It's free. Just Google for Zemra. You'll be able to download it. And how many can you find? It's probably several. And just a brief note about cryptocurrency. In January 2011, Bitcoin was born, and within the last 2 years, it's gone from up to as high as $31 to as low as almost less than a penny. But within the last 6 months, for whatever reason, it's remained stable between $4 to $7. In addition to Bitcoin, there's other cryptocurrencies that have emerged to compete with it, things like Solidcoin. Solidcoin's definitely not worth as much. They're probably only worth a few cents a coin, but it's the same principles, same algorithms, same distributed peer-to-peer network type deal, and it's all the prices are based on supply and demand. And when Bitcoin came out, you had a few darknet sites who would do things like sell drugs or sell other illegal transactions are very possible with Bitcoin because it's just like cash. There's no central authority. People can send a physical encrypted file from one person to another, and the value of that file is just agreed upon by the buyers in the marketplace in general, just like worthless Federal Reserve fiat currency or whatever. It's just it's trusted by the users, and the supply and demand sets the market rate. Schumer from the Senate made a big deal about it when it got into the news about, you know, the Silk Road drug marketplace that takes Bitcoin. But that's really kind of an anomaly. For the most part, Bitcoin hasn't really been a big player within the underground economy. You'll see it every now and then. A few people will accept it, but it's mostly just because they're kind of curious in the concept of cryptocurrency. But it's not really an accepted form. And I believe that to be because of the market fluctuations. The malicious actors are still making use of Liberty Reserve or Yandex money, which is another fairly new one. Which is matched, you know, 1-to-1 to the U.S. dollar or whatever currency it is in the country they're using, the country that they're in. The market fluctuations of Bitcoin make it pretty unattractive for long-term cybercrime operations because of the crazy fluctuations, you know, $31 to less than a penny. People who are engaged in digital crime for a living, they don't want to place that gamble on it yet. So it's again, while there's a few malicious actors that do take Bitcoin, and there's even been botnets based off Bitcoin, where if you get infected, your machine just starts mining Bitcoin, and then will send the coin that it mines to a destination wallet. And there are several kits like that are circulating, and I haven't reversed any of them, but they seem to be fairly interesting. Aside from those few little curious anomalies, it hasn't really gained a foothold as the currency of choice within the underground, and that's probably a good thing because Bitcoin can be used to do a whole bunch of legitimate cool things. So you could buy hosting with it, you could buy, you know, I've even bought beef jerky with it. It's really cool. As long as the mainstream media and government isn't focusing on the things that can be done with it, there's a potential for a lot of good to be done with it. But my impression is that Bitcoin is seen as an actual threat to the current financial system that's in place because it's a decentralized peer-to-peer digital currency that is actually worth more than the U.S. dollar right now. So what's to come in the future? What's next? Most likely, I predict we're going to see an increase in mobile device malware as more and more people start using their phones to do bank transactions, email, and just kind of centralizing all their logins onto their phone, especially as multi-factor authentication makes use of cell phones. Mobile device malware is going to be an integral part of cybercrime toolkits because they're going to be needed to infect phones in order to extract the multi-factor authentication credentials, which are going to be needed for a lot of web applications, and that's already starting to come out. As HTML5 becomes more popular, there's going to be more client-side attack vectors. There's going to be more browser vulnerabilities that are going to be leveraged. Client-side SQL injections are going to become more and more common on both mobile devices and desktop PCs because HTML5 allows the creation of client-side SQL databases. And there's going to be new XSS attacks variants that are going to be available because HTML5 is using because HTML5 allows for new types of commands and functions. And as far as DDoS attacks go, as more and more of these toolkits are being released, as it becomes easier and easier to launch significant attacks using large amounts of bandwidth, it's going to continue to grow and become an issue. Again, here are some resources for anyone who would like more information on any of the stuff that was discussed today. All the DDoS tools that were discussed are available from the threat advisory section at prolexic.com. It's free to the public. Just go ahead and download it. The Collective Intelligence Framework is a really, really neat project that's recently been developed where it'll take the feeds from all the different malware tracking sites like Zeus Tracker, CleanMX, SpyEye Tracker. If you can name it, it's already on the list. And then it centralizes it all so that you're not having to basically bounce through all these different resources to pull command and control centers. It's just a collective intelligence framework will just centralize it all and pull all sorts of statistics and data through it. Regarding one of the Prolexic Threat Advisories and the Dirt Jumper Threat Advisory, we have a tool that we release called dirtdozer.py, and you can feed a list of command and control servers to the Python script. It will fingerprint them if they're Dirt Jumper, tell you the type of attack and the target of the attack. So if you have a list of command and control servers, you can identify who's being hit with Dirt Jumper and how. And some good open source intelligence resources just to get a good feeling of what's going on in the underground. OpenSC.ws is a malware forum. It's up and down all the time because it's a malware forum. A lot of good leaks end up showing up there before they show up anywhere else. KrebsOnSecurity.com. That's Brian Krebs, an investigative journalist. He's always putting out real good information about developments in the digital underground. CyberWarNews.info is a good gossip page for hacker group rival battles and stuff, and who's defacing who and who's doxing who. And ZoneH.org, real cool archive of defaced websites. There's all these different defacement crews that are just, anytime that they'll hit like a bulk list of domains, deface them all, they'll all try to get rep points by posting up on ZoneH.org. And pastebin.com for pretty much everything else. Just search for the keywords and you will find stuff. And thank you. Anyone wants to contact me, alex@hackmiami.info. We got all the crimeware kits downstairs for anyone who wants to try out any of the vulnerabilities. And that's at the Hack Miami table. You'll see a big %27 on the table in the mezzanine level. And if there's any questions, I'll take questions. Thank you very much. Oh, there's a question in the back. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the full question. What's the overall situation with... you're saying delivering malware through peer-to-peer networks? I wasn't able to hear everything because it's pretty noisy, but there are all sorts of vectors of exploitation which are being leveraged for these types of toolkits. Pretty much if you can envision it, it's being done. Right. Well, the bootloaders are usually they're usually just a single executable application that some of the real fancy ones will do like a PHP MySQL thing and they'll sell services so that people can pay a fee to log into the bootloader and then run their own lists. But for the most part, the attacker needs to already have a list. You just need to know the URL of where the bootloader is at, and then you can send it target and time limits, and it'll start hitting it. There's still exploits being delivered through advertisements like flash vulnerabilities. It's just not as prevalent anymore because Adobe's done a pretty good job over the last 2 years of fixing that. But there are still 0 days to get discovered in flash, and that infections through through dirty advertisements is still a very common thing. And also regarding if you're talking about adware, like the advertisements that infect the machine and start giving you the pop-ups and stuff, those are usually already existing, and they use that to push out another executable. In a target, or basically the way the exploit kits work is they'll fingerprint the attack. They'll hit everything and they'll just see what's vulnerable. And Java is usually the last resort because most people run Java. So it'll try to do a browser exploit. If that doesn't work, it'll try to do a flash exploit. If that doesn't work, then it'll try to load up a Java applet. And an interesting example of a target attack is the Brian Krebs blog. He would go on to certain underground forums, and once they discovered that it was an investigative journalist, they decided to buy ad space on his website that was maliciously coded. And he had to approve it, so he caught it. But if it had gone all the way through, he would have it would have started affecting people. Yeah, it's very possible to embed iframes and dirty JavaScript into advertisements that are purchased, and that's still a very common infection method for drive-by downloads. Yeah, that does exist. There has been JavaScript versions of the low orbit ion cannon and other similar DDoS tools where people can just start sticking iframes on infected sites, and basically just by hitting that website, the JavaScript will start making the visitor start sending GET requests. So basically you're able to distribute all those attacks against a legitimate user base. So as long as the website's open, attacks are being run. So that definitely exists, and that's another stepping stone of where things are probably going to be going more into the future. Basically, DDoS without infection. Any other questions? I believe, again, this is my hypothesis. I don't have any proof of this, but I believe a lot of the mobile applications and enumerations of the existing crime kits, like Mobile Zeus, I believe it's probably developed by third parties who are obtaining the leaked code and then just making changes to it. But I'm pretty sure some of the original authors might still be involved with that. But there's also been rumor and chatter within the underground that the authors have retired and that type of stuff. So really, who knows? It's all a bunch of handles, and all the handles could be the same person. Any more questions? All right. Well, thank you all for coming out.
Guys, my name is Val. If anyone came here not just to listen to the lecture, but maybe make another acquaintance, I'm Russian, obviously my English is not perfect, but I'm available, so you can just come to me.